So, from Nagarjuna, all actions of body, speech, and mind created with an attitude of greed, hatred, and or ignorance lead to suffering. From actions created with the opposite attitudes of love, compassion, or wisdom, only happiness arises. That is the simplest summary of it all. And you notice that the emphasis there, I mean, indeed, they're actions of body, speech, and mind, but the created with the attitude, it's the motivation, the intent that gives the action its karmic impetus and its karmic direction, and it's the thing that determines whether that mind state or that speech or that action, whether that is going to result in happiness or whether it results in unhappiness. So we haven't emphasized this too much, but just to say, you know, it's the particular teaching of the Buddha that, you know, he's not saying these are the rules. You know, he's not handing us rules from his own wisdom and insight. He, due to their results, he defines the actions as problematic or as positive. So it's based on their results. So you start with, well, what are the results? The results are either happiness, what we're experiencing is happiness, or we're experiencing unhappiness, and what's the cause? So we're working backwards, you see? That makes a little difference. That makes a little difference. It's a scientific approach. It's an investigative approach. We're interested in what are the causes of happiness? What are the causes of suffering? We want to get control of those causes. Okay, well, let's investigate. Let's see what causes what really in our experience. So, you know, this is a compassion for yourself, right? This is like your first, most mature compassion for yourself, wanting yourself not to suffer. Yeah? You know, we think, oh, compassion for myself is trying to get everything I want. Make myself happy by getting everything that, you know, fires my desire neurons. So whatever I want, I should get it. That will make me happy. That's compassion for myself. But is it? Is that a mature compassion for oneself? Actually, the compassion for oneself is to see, you know, what is this really upsetting, distressing experience in life? And what are the causes of it? And can I free myself from that? So the practice of ethics is about, most fundamentally, it is about compassion for oneself. Even though the harms, as it turns out, are defined, the negative actions, as it turns out, are defined by, they happen to be actions that harm others. Yeah? But what the bottom line is, it's compassion for ourselves really first. I mean, this is our process of development. And even in the Mahayana, you start with compassion for yourself and the whole practice of ethics first. You don't like just all of a sudden you're going to help all sentient beings. And I'll get around to, you know, spiffing up my own behavior later. No, you work with your own behavior, and you work with your, and then in the context of Four Noble Truths, you work with your own mind in mental states. You get your own act together. You get control over your anger and attachment. And that is compassion for oneself. And then based on your growing wisdom sense of your interdependence with all sentient beings, then this interest in the welfare of others begins to bloom, because we understand that our own happiness is so closely interconnected with the happiness of others. So that compassion for ourselves is completely compatible with compassion for others. Two sides of the same coin. So, see, I thought there was something else I was going to say, but guess not. Okay, one little thing we have to... Oh, yeah, I know. There was, speaking of compassion for others, there was one set of positive actions, some that we didn't really talk about yesterday. I want to just quickly run through them. Yeah. So first we said we had refraining from harm, which is refraining from the 10 negative actions. Yeah, harm for others and harm for oneself. So there's that whole category of refraining, and those are positive actions, just the mere not doing of the harmful actions. Yeah. Then the second category we said were the actions that are the corollary to the negative actions. They're the positive, they're the positive pair, they're the positive side of the negative actions. For instance, the negative action not to kill, well, that has a positive karma side, a positive action, which is to care for life, to protect beings. Yeah? So we went through all 10 actions like that. Then there was a third set, which you get actually in the Bodhisattva practice, the Bodhisattva vows, but it's important to note that this is on the horizon here in our practice, and that is basically the good actions of benefiting others. And these are classic, but they're all actions that accrue that are very strong positive karma. And I'm just going to read through them very quickly because they're easy to understand. You already know what they all are, but I want you to understand that Buddhism also brings these to mind. So for instance, there's 13 classically, and once again this is just a list, and of course there's a million others, but these are examples. So there's helping the suffering or the sick. Yeah? Giving counsel to those who are confused or unable to help themselves. Hopefully when your counsel is asked for. Providing help to those who need it to realize their positive goals. Protecting those who are afraid or in danger. And that includes even animals, yes? Comforting those who are grieving, who have lost a loved one. Helping those who are poor or needy. Providing those who need a place to stay, travelers, Dharma practitioners, people without housing, helping to reconcile those who have quarreled. I'm trying to just speak just a little slow enough so those of you who are writing can, can kind of make the list. Supporting those who wish to practice the Dharma. Supporting Dharma practitioners. Or others who want to, who are acting constructively. Wouldn't even have to be just Dharma practitioners. Any kind of, any people on a spiritual path who you can help along on their path, providing what they need, resources. And finally, stopping those who are acting negatively, harmfully, or about to do so. Somehow we don't talk about those very much, very often, in the Dharma world, and probably we should talk about them more. Okay, moving on then to one last little bit, which is the paramitas. Of course, all of the paramitas are constructive, positive actions. So we haven't even mentioned meditation, which is clearly a tremendous act of positive karma. And your diligence, your effort in your practice. Concentration itself, of course. Okay, I think that's all pretty really easy to understand, but important to in your whole big overview of how it all fits together and how it all works to understand to get an idea of the largeness of the field of benefit of beneficial actions and positive karmic actions. Okay, one more little thing we have to do before we get to the grand finale of purification. And that is talk about the four karmic results, which we have mentioned already a bit, but we need to put a little order in them. First of all, we've talked about throwing karma. And we've talked about that throwing karma, which is that karma which impels an actual rebirth. Yeah? So it gives rise to the body and mind upon rebirth. Yeah? And we also said that one can even think of rebirth as in rebirth in like the next day, because our mind and body is changing so completely and so rapidly. In one way, you could say we die every day and or almost every moment and are completely reborn, which is, I mean, this is what allows us to make progress in our lives, isn't it? It is because we have this capacity for change, isn't it? That's why if we were all, you know, fixed, solid, permanent, unchanging moment to moment, we'd have no possibility for creating causes and having the effect arise, yeah? So, this throwing karma, and we said that an action, we've repeated this a number of times, an action that has that kind of power has to be complete, yeah? It has to have all four conditions, including that intention, and the action has to be actually done, and there has to be satisfaction and rejoicing in whatever the action is at the end, at the completion. Yeah? Right? So we said there's an object, there's the correct object, the intention, the action is done, and there is rejoicing. And this is also on your sheet there, too, if you missed those. And we said this... If any of those are missing from the action, and it's positive or negative, right? If any of those are missing, then the action is not so strong. It doesn't have the power to, like, actually impel a rebirth. It'll still have its karmic effect, but not so strong as that. And then we said this fourth point of rejoicing or regret is very important, because when, you know, in terms of those actions that we just are not powerful enough to stop, including mental states, we're not powerful enough, or we're not mindful enough to catch it, because we are practitioners, we're learners, we're on the path, so negative actions slip by us, and of course negative mental actions happen by the bucketful. So the important part then, the important piece of the technology of karma, is to understand that what you don't rejoice in, if you regret it, if you know this is a problem, the karma doesn't have so much energy. So you see, the knowing what to abandon and what to practice is so important. I just can't stress enough that this is a wisdom tradition. It is our happiness is increased by our wisdom. Our unhappiness arises due to not knowing, due to ignorance. So just the knowing that the thing is a problem and regretting it is enough to move you a little bit forward on your path, in your progress. Yeah? Now, so, okay, I do one little detour here. So we might have the feeling, oh, that's not fair. And it isn't fair in a justice kind of way. And we said that karma is not a fairness or justice principle. It's like gravity. It is a machine. Karma is a machine. It happens whether we know it's happening, whether we don't know it's happening, whether we've had the opportunity to go to a Dharma class, whether we're 3 years old, whether we're whether we're an animal who doesn't know that killing is wrong. Yeah. Nevertheless, there are negative, harmful actions arise in future with the result of future suffering. Yeah. So whenever you can, the hope here is whenever you can, you get your foot in the door and you bring some understanding into your actions. That understanding is huge. It has the power to change the whole trajectory of your consciousness, actually. Actually, even just one moment of understanding. Who is it that says, maybe this was Nagarjuna again, you can tell I like Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna says, even just one moment of doubt that things may not be the way they appear to be will shake the foundations of the world. And that's just a doubt. Maybe things aren't permanent. Maybe people don't have an inherent nature. Maybe people aren't. Maybe there's no such thing as a bad person or a good person fixed. Yeah? Just a little doubt is enough to rock your world. Okay, so throwing karma needs all four complete conditions. Yeah? The other three results are called completing karmas. And they don't have all four conditions. And I'll give you, because I'm going to try to blaze through this quickly and get on to the important purification, I'm just going to give you really simple examples. So, for instance, the first is it's called the result that corresponds to the cause. So the result is like the cause. And this is what people think of as karma, you know, the kind of the folk, the folk understanding of karma, what goes around comes around, that kind of thing. You know, if you steal from people, you will lose your stuff. People will steal from you. Or if you lie to people, people will lie to you. You know, that's very as we said, that's actually kind of not very sophisticated understanding of karma, because of course, as we said, once the action is completed, then it starts to interact with all the conditions in the world. So we said it can increase and it can ripen in a way that's actually quite a bit different than the action. For instance, they say that generosity, the result of generosity, the result similar to the cause is resources. Yeah. Okay, so then the next one, and they say that this is actually the most kind of dangerous of the results, and that is the habit that is created. So this is the result, which is a habitual tendency to do the action. And of course, why is this so dangerous? Because it means we will repeat the thing. And as we said, frequency is one of the factors for weight and makes an action stronger. Things that we do over and over and over again get stronger. And then, of course, if you know, the habitual tendency to do the thing again means, you know, it's, as we all know, with our habits are hard. You know, something that we do once, it's not so difficult to refrain from that in the future, but like if we do it over and over and over again, it gets stronger and stronger. What we familiarize with becomes stronger. This is a basic Dharma practice principle. It's like basic Dharma psychology. Whatever you familiarize your mind with, it becomes stronger. This is why it's important to... This is why you just can't read a book on Dharma and, you know, change your mind. This is why you go to Dharma teachings frequently. This is why you go on retreat. This is why you have Dharma friends. This is why you listen to Dharma teachings. This is why you read Dharma books, because you need repeated contact with the Dharma, and that it's the simple mechanism of familiarization. It carves a new groove in the mind. Only it's the groove you're choosing instead of the groove that has worn into your consciousness through lack of mindfulness. And this is why you have a meditation practice every day. This is why meditation practice every day is so much more effective than, like, I'm sorry, going on retreat once, you know, for a week, once in a year, is not nearly so potent a transformational action as having a daily meditation practice, because that repeated familiarization, you know, it builds the habit. Better even every day, you know, a half an hour every day is better than like 2 hours once a week, for instance. Actually, I shouldn't even be giving. Venerable Dhammadina may have different recommendations, but I like to. I do, for students in Seattle that are beginners, you know, you tell them, oh, you really need 45 minutes to even really get into the groove. Well, they're not going to. You know, they'll sit 45 minutes, and they sit 45 minutes once, and then and then that's it, because you know, unless you have a lot of motivation, a lot of commitment, yeah, it's painful. Yeah, so then, you know, to get them in the habit of like 10 minutes a day. Like Venerable hates this when I say 10 minutes a day. It's okay. She wants her yogis. She wants them sitting, half hour, 45 minutes. At least, really, 45 minutes, yes. What's that?
Twice a day.
No, she usually says once a day is okay. You give her an inch, she'll take a mile. Yes. Anyway, still it is important, the daily familiarization. Anyway, we're slightly off the topic, but the important point here is that familiarization. You know, the Tibetan word for meditation is gom, which means familiarization. I just cannot tell you if you want the technology, the way it works, it's the frequent, consistent practice that will be most powerful in terms of transforming your life. Mm-hmm. And that's just like a just basic kind of Dharma psychology. It's the simplest principle. Even if your half hour is not great, keeping the consistency, so powerful. Okay, so that's the third result, or the second of the completing karmas. And then finally, the last is what they call their environmental result. And that's a very interesting result, and the traditional teaching is that our actions actually create the very environment that we, the external environment that we live in. And of course that has a whole new meaning now on our planet, because of course we are creating with our actions the environment we will live in. And even in future lives, we will live in the environment that we are creating right now. It's pretty easy correlation to see, actually. And I dare say if human beings had a lot of confidence in future lives and rebirth, we would be a lot more careful with our planet. We would be thinking, well, we better not burn up all that oil in one generation. We better not cook all of our forests on the whole planet. We better not dirty our water. And what are we doing with all that radioactive waste that somebody's going to have to clean up, 10,000 years from now? Who's going to clean it up? We will. Okay, so now into purification. So the thing about, purification, it's a very psychologically smart and healthy practice, which basically it's once again, it's a learning practice. It's a wisdom practice. It's not a it's not a faith-based or ritual practice. We're not invoking someone to forgive us or doing any magic thing to earn forgiveness or expiation of our negative actions. It's a learning practice. It's a learning practice. And there are rituals, in Buddhist rituals, that purification is embedded into. But still, the mechanism is a learning mechanism. Yeah, that ritual just kind of, because we're beings who respond to ritual. And it's a skillful means for helping many people have respond to ritual. But still, the practice itself is one intended to increase our sensitivity. So basically, a purification practice is increasing our sensitivity and our awareness. And from the Buddhist perspective, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that cannot be purified. There is nothing that cannot be purified. We might have to practice with a thing for a while. It may take us a little while, but there's nothing that cannot be purified. The strongest purifying experience, or the strongest purifying factor, of course, for a Dharma practitioner is the actual realization of emptiness. As they say, that cuts karmic causes from the root. Finally. And you can see how that works, because of course the whole process of realizing emptiness is a process of increasing one's openness. Like sometimes some people like to translate emptiness as openness even. It's a spaciousness, isn't it? It's a lack of being fixed and caught in a particular it's like this. Yeah? So it's got a lot of possibility and space. And so then it's very sensitive, because it can encompass the whole radiating process of reality. So, but lacking that, in lieu of that, or meantime, while we're waiting for that to happen, while we're waiting for that great moment, there is, come to our rescue, the four opponent powers. Now, the four opponent powers don't cut the karmic seed. It doesn't burn it up for good. It doesn't cut the root. But it prevents the karmic cause from ripening. So you might even say you are creating conditions. Remember, we said for a cause to ripen, there have to be all the right conditions. So those four opponent powers, they're going to create conditions that will interfere with the ripening of that karma, of all those karmas, yeah? Then in the meantime, of course, if those negative karmas don't ripen, then that gives us more time and space to move forward with our project of realizing emptiness, yeah? Because that's part of the reason we don't want those karmas to ripen, is that many of them interfere with our practice, our ability to practice. So those four opponent powers. (Clears throat) And sometimes these are given different names, and I've got this little set of four that all begin with R's. But if you read around, you might see them with different, translated in different ways. and sometimes even they're given in slightly different order. But I like to start with regret. We've talked about regret already a lot. And we've said, and we have said that it's the regret that is the really powerful purifier. And even we've said, if you remember, that's one of our four factors for complete action. And we've also said that regret is one of the factors the presence of an opponent mental state is one of the factors that can weaken a particular karma. Yeah, so we've already mentioned regret twice in those two contexts. Here, in the formal Four Opponent Powers practice, we generate regret, which is, you know, it's a wisdom. It's not like an emotional thing. We think of guilt as like an emotional. It's a wisdom. We see that this was a mistake. We regret it in the same way, I like to say, as if we put your finger on the hot stove. You regret it. Ah! you think, wish I hadn't done that. You don't think I'm a bad person because I put my finger on the stove. Yeah? You don't take that personal. You understand that it's a mistake. And once again, to say, if we understood the suffering results, if we understood and really had confidence in the suffering results of our negative actions, we would be a lot less likely to engage in them. Yeah? So the regret is, it stems from a confidence, a kind of knowing or a wisdom that sees that this will have negative results. Yeah? Like, oh, I lied to this person, and I see this was a real mistake. It's going to it's going to upset them. It's going to undermine their trust in me. It's going to hurt me when they find out that I lied to them. You know, so we regret it because we see the harmful results for both the other and for ourselves. Yeah? So that regret is, you know, it's a real teacher. Regret is the, you know, it's the mental factor of a seasoned practitioner. It takes practice to be capable of regret. First of all, we have to see that there's a problem, and then we have to have enough self-transparency and self-honesty to give it up and say this was a mistake instead of trying to rationalize it or deny it. So this regret is a great teacher. It's a very positive mental state, and it has its own karma. Positive mental state. It has it's a kusala factor. It is a healthy, wise, clear, and eventually leading towards well-being, because it moves you to want to take care of the problem, to purify it, as opposed to, say, denial, which just keeps you, you know, stuck in the festering, you know, hidden from yourself thing. So your regret is your teacher, and so feel okay about your regret. You know, note it. Yes, that was a mistake, and wow, I'm so lucky, I regret it. My practice is flowering. I see it and I regret it. I have the courage to regret it. Oh, I can face it. And now we can unburden ourselves from this thing. It gives us a chance to finish it, to unburden ourselves. To lay down the baggage. So it's the exact opposite of denial.
Self-recrimination.
Yeah, right? Because we've got more to do. Okay. That's why. That's how we do it, because we don't stop there, because we've got a technology for working it out. Yeah? Okay, so we've got our regret. Second thing is, exactly there. We can't just stay there with the regret. We need more. Yeah? So we want, the second is repair. Repair the relationship. Now, there's two different ways that one causes harm. There's two different ways that one can cause harm, two different kinds of harm that arise from negative actions. We harm others, or we violate our own standards, our own highest commitment to our own personal ethics, or our own personal values, our own personal standards. Yeah? So, by way of repairing our those actions that don't hurt, they don't harm someone else, but they are a harm to ourselves, to our practice, to our commitments. They transgress our personal commitments, our commitments to ourselves. Yeah. So we repair that relationship with ourselves, with our higher commitments, by taking refuge. And you can formally take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, with whichever refuge recitation or contemplation that you are in the habit of engaging in, whatever is meaningful to you. And at the core of that, of course, at the core of that, you know, we say that the Dharma, between the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the Dharma is the actual refuge. It's the thing that is really protective in our lives. And that Dharma, what is that Dharma? That Dharma is, what is Dharma in the Four Noble Truths? Anybody know? True paths and true cessations. True paths and true cessations. Out of the four, you've got true sufferings, you've got true origins, and then you've got the path and cessation. True paths and true cessations are Dharma. So you can think like you're committed to the cessation of anger, attachment, and ignorance as your very noble and beautiful goal. You can think you're committed to this path of the Eightfold Noble Path of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So, you know, even say you're purifying your, you know, lethargy and lack of diligence, for instance, in your concentration practice. Well, nobody would call that anything bad or evil, right? That's just a personal commitment. But there is, if you make a commitment to your Dharma practice, your daily practice, and you fail in that, that's something to be purified. Yeah? You see that? It wouldn't be a negative karma for somebody who wasn't didn't make that commitment, but you have in your, say you have, I mean, if you have, if you have that commitment to a daily practice, for instance. So, or another way you could think of that recommitting, you can think just a very simple refuge as your commitment to the values and the importance of wisdom and compassion in your life. And that your commitment to wisdom and compassion is the protective commitment, the central, the values that you believe are protective and that you feel your life is oriented towards and that are most important and dear to your heart. Yeah. So you repair your relationship with your commitment, however you want to. We could talk about refuge, of course, for a whole nother. We could do a whole retreat on refuge. So there's a lot to say about that, but just very simply, just a few things about refuge. So that's so to repair your relationship with yourself, you recommit to your values, like that. However, is meaningful to you. Now, if it's someone else that you have harmed, if there is someone else you have harmed, in the Mahayana tradition here, we would say you take bodhicitta, you reconfirm your bodhicitta, you confirm, make, recommit to your bodhicitta. How many people here know what bodhicitta is? Okay, let's think of something a little different here. If you know what bodhicitta is, you can take bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is basically the commitment to develop fully one's wisdom and compassion and purify all negative qualities in order to be of benefit to all sentient beings without exception. Including friends, enemies, and strangers.
Yeah, that's all it is.
That's all it is. That's all it is. But lacking that, I think to make recommit yourself to your to the importance of compassion in your life. I think your commitment to renew your commitment to compassion, your commitment to the alleviation of others' suffering. Because of course that's what happens when we harm others. That's we've kind of forgotten that we care whether they suffer or not. Yeah, so our commitment to compassion, then we renew our commitment to compassion in whatever way is meaningful to you to renew that commitment to not harming others, which is a commitment to compassion. Does that make sense? Questions or comments on that particular point? We're good. Okay. Okay then. So in some ways you can say that this repairing the relationship is in both cases, whether it's yourself or others, it's recommitting yourself to your values, to what is to making note of and recommitting to yourself to your values. Okay, then the third of the four opponent powers, which naturally follows from the first two, is resolve, which is the resolve not to engage in that negative action again. And they like to say it should be for a certain length of time. So if it's a mental state, you know, it might be like for the next hour. Or if it's a habit of speech and you're still at work It might just be till the end of the workday. His Holiness likes to say, don't be afraid to commit, to make a big commitment, even if you might fail. He says, because you'll never exceed what your highest aspiration for yourself is. So he says, don't be afraid. You can always purify the break. If the negative action or the akusala action is a mental state which might be very intractable, might be very difficult to just say it's not, say you're having anxiety, that's an akusala mental state, but you want to work with it here within the four opponent powers, but there's no way you can stop it. Yeah. So the commitment might be to bring your mindfulness to that mental state and try your best not to buy into it or let it go when it arises, to let it go when it arises. So, you know, you need to be skillful with your dear and tender mind here. And remember that just injecting the wisdom into the mindfulness, the awareness, and the sensitivity is what you're doing in the process. So it's not like a heavy thing that's supposed to give you yet more contraction around your practice. It should be a freeing and liberating kind of experience, your relationship with the four opponent powers. Okay, so your resolve. it might be something that you could say, I'm never doing that again for the rest of my life. I'm done. Could be. If it hasn't already progressed to the habit stage. So once it's into that habit stage, that's hard. So be patient. Look for small successes, because those small successes are the moving forward into growth and development of your realization and your purification. Okay, so then finally, the last part, the last of the four, is remedial action. So here you're engaging in some kind of real action that's creating an energy, kind of a counterbalance energy. Something that counterbalances the negative action. Now, of course, if you can fix the thing, you want to fix the thing. That's the most clearest counterbalance. So you've stolen, I don't know, you've stolen, a quart of milk from the grocery. You've stolen a quart of milk for the grocery. Probably you don't want to go back into the grocery and say, hey, I've stolen this, because they might arrest you. But you can take it back and say, "Oh, here, I didn't pay for this, and I, sorry. Here it is in my bag." Anyway, somebody told us a story about it was a doctor, wasn't it? Who, I guess, they had removed scheduled narcotics from. They had closed up a practice, and they had removed scheduled drugs from their office, and they hadn't properly filed it. So they did something like, I don't know, they called up the place and said, hey, I got these things, and I want to give them back to you guys or do something. Well, they got, they were served. So yeah, you got to be a little bit wise and careful there about how you go about your remedial action here. The idea isn't to suffer, you're not trying to punish. The idea isn't punishment, okay? So you do it in a skillful way, and then also the remedial action, like. Maybe it's somebody you need to apologize to, but maybe they don't want to hear you. They might not want your apology. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm in the middle of my opponent powers. You have to listen to my apology. quick. So, again, we have to be skillful. We have to be skillful, and sometimes we just have to do something that's really kind of unrelated to the action. Maybe the person is no longer available to remedy the action. So there's a whole array of other actions that we can engage in. We can, do volunteer work. We can engage in an act of generosity. We can kind of match the action to the weight of... I am going to finish this up really quickly here because we actually do have to leave in 5 minutes. Also meditation, reading Dharma books, all of these things are remedial actions. Meditation on emptiness is a beautiful remedial action. Any kind-hearted action to any act of generosity or to help, any helping action. And you do it with the mind that this is my remedial action. So you designate it. You set your motivation and you make your dedication in that way. Yeah. So in your practice of the Four Opponent Powers, when you sit down to meditate on your purification, you'll think, okay, this is what kind of purification remedial action I'd like to do. And this is an important part, because this is an important part of the process, just exactly for the reason that you said, because we don't want to wallow in guilt and self-recrimination. We actually want to heal the problem in the world that we created. Yeah. And sometimes we can't heal that directly, but we can do something positive in the world that will kind of offset that debt to others. Any questions on that? Questions, comments?
I just have another question.
Yeah.
So when you were going through these, mm-hmm. I was kind of in my mind thinking of all these examples, mm-hmm. and I would have apologized and returned the milk all the way for repair.
You would have, I'm sorry?
That's what I was thinking about when you were on
that. That you would have...
Like, apologized to someone or returned the milk or whatever. So does repair mostly just kind of mean with your repair, like your take, like personally? What
your,
would it look like repair with someone else? Okay,
in terms of repair, sometimes they call this reliance. The first, so that one that's actually called repair, it's sort of repairing one's own commitments, one's own broken, one's own failing to oneself. Yeah, because we've failed ourselves. So that's where repairing our commitments to others or we're repairing our commitments to ourselves. That's the repair. The remedial action is the place in which we're actually doing something to create a counterbalancing energy in the world. And that can be something actively to remedy, to actually right the wrong, if it's possible. And if it's not, it's to engage in an action that kind of creates an energy that we feel that debt has, that debt to the world is paid. Or if the thing that we're working with and purifying is a mental state, maybe say it's anger, and we have a habitual anger, and we're working to purify anger, ill will that arises to the mind. Then it would be extremely appropriate, all week I'm going to meditate on metta, for instance. I'm going to focus on metta in my practice in the process of purifying this, for instance.
It seems like this kind of follows the usual question of like, the retreats.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of visiting the cause, you know, repairing the cause.
Yeah. Yeah, the cause, the situation, and the cause. Yeah, something like that.
Loosely.
Yeah. Purification definitely comes within the Four Noble Truths. And, you know, they say that, you know, most of our practice is, you know, it's generating concentration, compassion, patience. It's generating, you know, qualities and realization. And on the other hand, it's purifying. So of the two big categories in our practice, purification is one. And of course, the purification helps our meditation, because as the mind is cleared up of all these lingering, energy draining, you know, guilt places, then of course all that energy is freed up, and there's a lot more clarity and ease in the mind, and more confidence in oneself. Yeah, more trust in oneself. Tomorrow morning I'll lead you through the, I think in the 11 o'clock, I have the 11 o'clock session, don't I, tomorrow? Tomorrow morning I'll lead you through a purification meditation. So we'll walk through the four opponent powers. So, yeah, so you can be thinking of all of your negative actions you want to purify.
Then, or
your choice.
Yeah, there's been a lot of merging with 12 step, like people looking at that, but boy, this sure is mirrors it.
Yeah, it's good psychology.
Yeah.
It's good old psychology, and these principles are, for instance, in the Tibetan tradition, they are embedded in, say, you probably have not heard of this, but the Vajrasattva practice, for instance, which is a sadhana practice of purification. And the Buddha Vajrasattva is particularly the Buddha of purification. And there's a whole sadhana practice with a visualization in which these four steps are embedded in that old, ancient sadhana practice. It's very beautiful. People always like the Vajrasattva. Maybe someday we'll do a Vajrasattva purification retreat. or maybe not. Even in Seattle we haven't done that. So let us dedicate. So let's just think, may all of our positive karma that we've created today, all these positive actions, all of our diligence and our practice, our sincerity, our listening, our sitting when we're tired, our careful mindfulness, the kindness and generosity of our cooks and staff. Let's dedicate all of that positive energy and think, with all that positive energy, may we develop wisdom and compassion. May we purify all of our negative karma. And may we then be free, light, clear, relaxed, and able to benefit each and every being with whom we're related, with whom we come in contact. See you tomorrow. Sleep well. Have good Feldenkrais.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.